Welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And well, if all goes well, two segments up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll speak with Enrique Diaz Alvarez, who is a fellow who works at a small hedge fund on Wall Street. We'll talk to him about the European crisis. And then we'll hear from Kurt Davies, who is the research director of Greenpeace USA, talking about the wind farm that's just been approved off Cape Cod and wind power in general, alternative energy, and the status of climate politics in Washington, D.C. Before all that, some words on the news. First of all, as I was coming by here, I noticed the March on Wall Street up the street, sponsored by a number of groups, including the AFL-CIO. I wish them luck. I really am not terribly optimistic about what is going to emerge out of Congress. There's just not the popular mobilization to force anything of any significance. The Goldman Sachs hearings earlier this week were entertaining, but it was certainly inspiring to see all those masters of the universe squirming a bit under the lights and under some occasionally intense questioning. But it strikes me as just a bunch of kind of a ritual sacrifice intended to appease an angry electorate. I don't expect all that much to come out of it. I hope I'm wrong, but I suspect that is the way it's going to turn out. Okay, in the economic news, the recovery continues with a couple of decent reports coming out of the housing market. Sales of both existing and especially new houses were up nicely in March. Much of this life, it's hard to say just how much, came from the tax credit for first-time buyers. You do have to wonder if the market can survive the withdrawal of that stimulus. Prices aren't recovering so quickly. The best measure of house prices we have, the S&P Case-Shiller Index, is up not quite 1% over the last year, although it's quite a change to see a positive number, even a small one, after all that strings of negative numbers. But the recent months have been kind of flat to down. Of course, the most recent figure is for February, which is ancient history in these precincts. But much of the gain happened late last year, and it doesn't seem to be continuing so far into early 2010. But the trend I've noted here over the past several weeks continues. People are buying again. The weekly chain store numbers are showing their best gain in years. Appropriately enough, the consumer confidence numbers from the Conference Board are showing an improving mood among the masses, mostly for the future, but perceptions of improvement in the job market were also impressive. It's hard to say how much of that perceived improvement in the labor market comes from personal experience and how much of it comes from hearing some more upbeat news in the media. But it does look like a recovery is underway. Or so the financial markets passionately believe, at least they did until bad news out of Europe, on which much more in a few minutes, inspired more prudent sorts to put the champagne back in the chiller for now. And the accurate words of Mohamed El-Aryan, head man at PIMCO, the world's largest bondholder, markets are placing too much emphasis on the cyclical tailwinds and not enough on the structural headwinds. We recognize that it will take time for the market to fully understand that the global crisis was not a flesh wound, that the balance sheet adjustment hasn't yet ended, that the post-crisis phase is inherently complex. We have seen massive stabilization of the financial markets, but the handoff from the financial stabilization to a robust recovery on Main Street, which translates into the large employment creation we need for growth, is proving much more difficult. So we worry over persistently high unemployment as well as the robustness of the social safety nets. That's the end of the quote from bondman El-Aryan. Aside from the use of the tired Main Street, which would never appear on this show except in a quote, this formulation can hardly be improved upon. It's striking to see one of the royalty of finance show more concern about social safety nets than just about anyone in political life. As I keep pointing out, the history of economies after financial crises is bleak. It typically takes years to mount any kind of sustained recovery. For now, we're being lifted by tax breaks and deficit spending. But tax breaks expire, and the deficit spending is set to be reversed within a year. And Obama's deficit commission is getting ready to bring out the really big and sharp knives. Of course, it's another thing whether any of that will be politically possible. Our credit system is still a mess, and it would be insane to go back to the model of the 2001-2007 expansion when debt grew nearly twice as fast as GDP, the most lopsided debt growth to GDP growth ratio in modern business cycle history. And despite all that credit juice in that last expansion, it was also the weakest of all of those in the period after World War II. The tailwinds are pleasant at the moment, but without any serious structural reforms, it's hard to see how the headwinds won't be back. And now closer to home. A member of Pacifica, one Christopher Bayard Comden, like many assassins, he's got three names, has proposed a resolution to the Pacifica National Board that would essentially require programmers to take 9/11 conspiracies seriously. It would increase airtime for truthers and deem those of us who don't buy this paranoid nonsense in violation of the Pacifica mission. The KPFK local board has already passed such a resolution, but no one's paid any attention to it, thank God. In fact, a KPFK producer told me earlier today that he wasn't even aware of it. He sensibly has been broadcasting critiques of this nuttery. All this Pacifica resolution needs, though, is a board member to introduce it, and it's up for a vote. First of all, it's appalling that anyone would contemplate forcing Pacifica producers to embrace a party line. I'd sooner give this all up than obey such a thing. But it's even worse that there are so many people who take this toxic waste seriously. Not only is it nonsensical in content, it destroys the mind. Obsessions about the melting point of steel and the shape of the non-existent hole in the Pentagon take on a life of their own. As a commenter on my blog put it, this sort of reasoning becomes quite literally like a paranoid's pathological mental processes. We, the political left in general, and Pacifica specifically, already have some serious credibility problems among the broad population. The last thing we need is further marginalization, especially of the self-imposed kind. As damaging as this sort of nonsense is, it's also politically destructive. Don't take my word for it. Connoisseurs of conspiracy might want to check out a 1998 report on Defense Department declassification procedures prepared by the consulting firm Booz Allen and Hamilton. It was posted to the Federation of American Scientists website, FAS.org. They recommend, and I'm quoting from this report now, they recommend that the use of the Internet could reduce the unrestrained public appetite for secrets by providing good faith distraction material. An example of such material, Booz Allen suggests, quote, diversion, list of interesting declassified material, i.e. Kennedy assassination data. So consider this, conspiracy theorists. Instead of analyzing all the rich material about capitalism and empire on the public record, you're doing the Pentagon's work for it by pursuing distractions. You'd almost think it's a conspiracy. Okay, now we'll take a break and talk about Europe.
You're so chic, dude, well, who love we? Babies of the mountain streamline, midnight new casino floors, dance the cha-cha through to sunrise, opens up exclusive doors for wow. Just like the windows look the same, so me and you, just me two, got to search for something new.
And that's the first stop on today's musical tour of my extended post-adolescence, Roxy Music, Virginia Plain from their album Roxy Music, the first one from 1972. God, it's almost 40 years. Wow. And now we're joined in the studio by Enrique Diaz Alvarez, who works for a small hedge fund and in spirit on Wall Street, not physically on Wall Street, but well, even though we are physically on Wall Street at the moment, and people are demonstrating against the institution just on the block right now as we speak. Welcome, Enrique.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I believe this is your radio debut, so
gentle.
A warm welcome on Behind the News. The markets are now in a tizzy over Europe, and I think a lot of Americans don't pay all that much attention, especially civilian Americans don't pay all that much attention. So let's do a little tour of the old world. The epicenter of the crisis right now is Greece, right? What is the problem with Greece?
Well, the fundamental problem with Greece is, in a nutshell, that it has too much government debt. This is not news, but the market started to notice it late last fall when a new government took over from the previous one after the general election and disclosed that the previous government had systematically lied about the size of the debt and the deficit.
Now, Greece has a long history of cooking the books.
Yes. So in a way, it is surprising that anybody was shocked by this, but shocked they were. As a consequence of this revelation, Greek bonds in the market started going down in price, meaning that Greece was supposed to had to pay higher and higher rates in order to place its substantial issuance of debt to repay the previous debt. This started in January. It accelerated over the last few weeks, and effectively 3 weeks ago reached the point where Greece was simply not able to place any bonds in the market at any level. At that point,
and Greece being that much in debt really needs to roll over its debts constantly.
Yes. We're not talking about an investment bank, because one critical difference between a country and an investment bank is both the level of leverage and what is called the maturity profile. Instead of having to roll over its debts every day, Greece has punctual obligations through the year. Typically, on a given year, Greece has to roll over about 15% of its debt, but we're still talking about a substantial amount.
And why is Greece so deeply in debt?
That's a good question. First, one should note that Greece was really bad in terms of government debt as a percentage of GDP. If you do a more traditional distress market analysis that adds up the external debt of both the government and the corporations and households of the country, Greece looks bad, but not as bad relative to the other southern European countries that are experiencing difficulties.
And those, of course, are what Wall Street is calling the pigs, right?
Yes.
Portugal, Italy.
Very pleasant way of referring to my country, among others. Spain.
Greece and Spain. Let's talk about some of those other countries, although one of them is up in northern Europe, Ireland. But let's make the rounds.
That is south in spirit, I guess.
Yeah, well, the periphery, I guess, would be the as opposed to the core. Now, there's talk. Spain had its debt downgraded on Wednesday.
Yes,
but it's still pretty high up there.
It's pretty high up there. It just got downgraded a couple of notches. By the way, even after the recent downgrade, it's important to note that Greece bonds are still accepted as collateral in the ECB. So it is any European bank can go to the auctions, should there be any auctions, which they're having obviously called off, buy these bonds and take it to the ECB and get the money to buy them, borrow the money, which sometimes the ECB does not get enough credit for what it's doing to fight the crisis. But this is what is right now enabling all these countries to place their bonds to the extent that they're placing them. We had an auction today with Italy, yesterday with Portugal. And one suspects that most of these bonds were bought by domestic banks that are then taking them to the ECB and getting the money from the European Central Bank.
And then doing what with that money, do we know?
Loaning it to buying the bond with them.
Uh-huh.
And so essentially, the Italian banks are buying the Italian government bonds at the auction with Trichet's money.
Yeah, so essentially the European Central Bank is keeping these troubled countries afloat.
Right now, yes.
And so Spain had a downgrading. What are the problems with the Spanish economy?
The Spanish economy, first of all, is much bigger than any of the other so-called peaks.
Greece is only, what, 3% of...
About that. It's 10 million people. Let's talk in terms of people. Greece has 10 million people. Spain has 45 million people. So while it is conceivable that it is possible to conceive of a Eurozone without Greece, I honestly don't think it's conceivable to think of a Eurozone as such without Spain. So Spain, first of all, the size is what makes it different. Second, it had a massive real estate bubble, one that, by the way, puts American real estate bubbles to shame, I'm sorry to say.
Say it with some pride.
Yes. Prices reach levels that are simply insane. And as a consequence of the bubble, the strange thing is that the public accounts in Spain look a lot better, whereas the private accounts look a lot worse. The borrowing in this case in Spain was done by the banks mostly from the rest of Europe, which because it wasn't growing as fast as Spain had a lot of surplus funds to loan. They loaned it to Spanish banks, which then proceeded to build hundreds of thousands of unnecessary homes.
So it was mostly residential real estate, the bubble?
Almost exclusively residential real estate, yes.
And what set it off? Anything in particular, or is it just one of the things that happened?
What sets off a bubble? Well, one thing you could blame is very low interest rates. Interest rates in Spain, once we joined the euro, the big benefit for Spain was we enjoyed the lowest real interest rates. Well, perhaps definitely the lowest nominal real interest rates in history, the lowest nominal rates, and perhaps real as well.
Before joining the euro, what was Spain's picture like? Did it have a weak currency and high interest rates, or was it better off than that?
Yes, the standard was a currency that was occasionally strong, but mostly periodically devalued. Essentially, every once in a cycle, there would be some severe devaluation with implicit promise that would be the last one.
And it never was.
And it never was.
So now that it gave out the peseta and adopted the euro, that outlet is no longer available.
Correct.
And then Italy, surprisingly, despite very high debt figures, also has a high level of domestic savings, so they're not looking
in
such trouble.
Italy, again, it's the opposite. The mirror case from Spain. They have the borrowing there has been done by the government, while the levels of mortgage debt and corporate debt are surprisingly low.
And a lot of most of it's domestic.
And most of it because of the fact that the government deficit is mirrored by very large private corporate and household surpluses, they have not. Their external debt position is entirely manageable.
Italians don't pay taxes. They just save the money.
Correct. And then they loan it to the government, which basically amounts to the same thing.
With interest. So Italy, then, is really not, for the moment, in any kind of serious trouble.
Well, the easiest way to measure the extent to which this country is in trouble is the spread. It was called the spread to German bonds. Germany is the gold standard. And they pay around 3% or less, actually considerably less after this week for their debt. And the question is how much more each country has to pay in order to issue debt than the Germans. And with Italy, that spread has widened. It means things have gotten worse for Italy. Of the so-called peaks, it remains the lowest, the one that the country seems to have less worries about.
Greece is paying, what, 7 or 8 points over German rates now?
Well, it's kind of a state of mind because there's no way they could issue at any price at these levels. That's why the bailout package was necessary. But if you went to the market and wanted to buy, say, $1 million worth, you would be paying short-term somewhere north of 15%, going down to the high single digits for 10 years and 30 years, which, by the way, it's a sign of the markets predicting imminent default when the credit curve gets inverted, when the country has to pay a lot more money to issue short-term, a lot more interest rate, I'm sorry, to issue short-term than it has to issue long-term. That's a sign that the markets are pricing in a significant chance of near-term default.
I want to get back to that topic in a moment. I should say I'm speaking with Enrique Diaz-Alvarez, who is works for a hedge fund, a little small hedge fund on Wall Street. The Irish economy hit the wall a little earlier than the others, and they also have a pretty advanced austerity program underway, right?
Yes. In fact, Ireland is being posited as sort of the poster child for how to solve this crisis of past excesses and excess debt and leverage. They hit the wall very early. They were very aggressive in cleaning up the issue. Their banks have essentially been nationalized. The government has assumed their liabilities and their assets as well. They have implemented some fairly severe budget cuts. And right now, Ireland is actually experiencing some fairly strong deflation, anywhere depending on which indication you use. Anywhere from -1% to -4% a year of inflation. And until recently, until these last couple of weeks, in fact, their spreads were relatively stable compared to the other ClotMed, let's use the more polite term of ClotMed countries. And then this week, it just joining the general distress.
Now, as often these things happen, the markets are overreacting, and some countries are unjustly getting punished for out of the fear of what's going on with Greece, right?
Yes, in relative terms. The question is, they might be all those bonds might be too cheap, and might be a buyer. It might be too expensive. It might be a sell. Some might be cheaper or maybe it's expensive than others, but the very difficult question is the entire basket, as we call it, cheap at these levels? And that is more difficult.
Now, it seems to me the fundamental problem, I don't know if you'd agree, is that a bunch of countries are yoked together in this monetary union, the creation of the euro, that were not really capable of competing with Germany, German levels of productivity. And in the past, when the countries are outside using their own currencies, they could devalue out of that problem. But now that they're inside this same economic space, you have countries on the periphery that are just no match for German economic power. Is that really the fundamental problem we're talking about?
Yes, I would say that it is, with a very strong caveat, is that, as we say in Wall Street, at what price? All these countries, most of them at least, were competitive when they joined the euro with Germany. The problem is that the euro has been around for 12 years, and during this time, Germany has experienced near zero inflation, wages in Germany have stagnated, the economy has not boomed, and yes, the German productivity has increased. So whereas in the Club Med countries, surprisingly in all of them, whether or not they experienced a boom during these years, the cost structure, which is a euphemism for wages and housing prices and other services, increased by anywhere from 3 to 5% a year. So whereas most of these countries joined the euro at a level that made sense, the lack of a transfer mechanism to make sure that these imbalances didn't adjust themselves means that now they're not competitive. Now, in the United States, for instance, another huge common currency with 50 states, if that happened, what would you have is a massive movement of labor from one state to another. From states that were experiencing booms, I'm sorry, from states that were in recession, the Midwest, for instance, to states that were booming, back before the bust, California, Florida, et cetera. That has not happened in Europe, though there's no legal barrier to it happening. The fact of the matter is that there's a lot of cultural barriers, linguistic barriers, and it hasn't happened, and it's not happening, and there's no sign it's going to happen. So the imbalances just grew and grew.
No, well, this is also, they've got one currency, but, you know, plenty of finance ministers, plenty of budgets. It's not a common space politically.
Yes.
So that's another contradiction. It's not just a matter of the competing productivities. These are not common polities.
Yes, and there's a sharp contrast between the whatever one may think of the bailout, the direct action that was taken, admittedly, belatedly, by the U.S. authorities to essentially and successfully end the panic, which they did, and the dithering that we're seeing in Europe, where as I said, bonds, Greek bonds have been selling off since January. They basically were cut off from market access 3 weeks ago. And we may soon get to the point where the bailout is agreed. And we're in May.
Well, they keep talking about the bailout for Greece. The numbers keep getting larger. Now they're floating numbers over 100 billion euros as necessary for a bailout of Greece. That I think a lot of Greece's creditors would certainly love that kind of bailout. You think anything like that's going to happen?
I am a little bit. I think it will happen eventually. I think that honestly, the prospect of Greek defaulting is too horrible to contemplate.
What would the consequences be?
First of all, that debt, in the case of Greece, unlike Italy, is not held by Greeks. It's held by French and German banks and other European banks.
But in itself, it's pretty small magnitudes compared to.
Yes, in itself it is, but who's going to buy a Spanish bond after Greek defaults? And then we're talking a serious problem because European banks hold, I think the figure I've heard is close to $1 trillion worth of Spanish debt, mostly private, some government.
So it seems to me that they've got two ways to go. One is to go through this period of trying to get through this crisis and then splitting apart the euro countries with some of the weaker peripheral countries leaving and leaving a core of Germany and a few of its other mighty friends. Or they develop some kind of looser bailout culture like the United States.
Yes, that's the choice. I just hope that we don't have a catastrophe forcing that is not a catastrophe that forces the European authorities to face to the fact that that's a choice.
Well, as you said to me in an email the other day, they don't have a Tim Geithner to come in and bail out Goldman Sachs, right?
Exactly.
Will this crisis produce such a figure?
It may or may not, but the institutional mechanism is not in place for such a figure to appear. That's the problem.
No, I think
the closest thing you could get to that is Trichet. I wouldn't be surprised as a last resort if once everything hits the fan, if you have
the ECB.
The head of the European Central Bank going to the market and instead of merely loaning money for people to buy these bonds, going ahead and just printing money by the bonds itself.
Yeah, but to mount a serious bailout, you also need real government money of a sort that you know, the TARP produced, for example, in the United States.
Well, not necessarily. You can just print it. There's all the consequences to money printing,
yeah.
But in a pinch.
But in American history, it seems like it's always taken, in modern American history, it's always taken the expenditures of some real government funds to get our way out of this sort of thing.
I would argue that the barrier between central bank monies and treasury bonds is not really a very clear one to me. I would like to merge those entities into one. And this is the only pan-European entity that has the institutional ability and the ability to act quickly enough to solve the financial crisis right now is the ECB.
And what about the options for Greece? It looks like the preferred option, certainly the only way the Germans can see going through this, is for Greece to undergo a deep recession and a massive cut in government spending and a cut in Greek standard of living. There's also the possibility that some of Greece's creditors could take a hit and get 80 cents on the dollar, 80 cents in the euro instead of 100. What do you think of the options for getting out of this?
I think restructuring, for the reasons I said earlier, it's not going to be a good option. We have the Lehman precedent. Everybody has it in mind. And I think it would be very bad for it to happen, and I don't think it will be allowed to happen. On the other hand, the bailout package as currently structured, I don't think it's sustainable. I mean, Greece is being charged a rate of 5%, which albeit is lower than they would have to pay in the market if they could sell bonds in the market at all. In a country that has whose debt to GDP ratio is 120%, and where inflation outside of the increases in value-added tax is running close to zero and probably going negative soon, given the shock to confidence that the Greeks must have experienced, that means that they need to run a surplus of 6% of GDP just to stay in place, debt-wise. Now, there's precedence for this. There's been, in Europe in the 80s and 90s, a variety of Scandinavian countries experienced crisis and fiscal adjustments, not quite of this magnitude, not quite of the magnitude of the fiscal adjustment that Greece is expected to go through, but close. The key differences, these countries were able to, there were several key differences. The first one in this country is the value. So exports provided the economic impetus that was lost to the deficit cuts. The second difference is that at no point did these countries have to do this in the middle of a synchronized recession. This means that the situation in Greece right now in the euro, in the middle of a synchronized global recession, is completely unlike those. And therefore, asking them to pay 5% as they roll over the debt, the bailout package, it's not an investment bank, so the bailout money gives them enough to meet the redemption schedule for the rest of the year, sure. But what's going to happen next year, the year after? As the economy contracts, the tax base shrinks, and they still have to service this enormous debt at rates that are converging to 5%.
We've only got a few seconds left, but do you think the Eurozone is going to hold together, or is it going to go flying apart?
I think it's going to hold together through the end of this month, and unfortunately, that's all I get. After that, I'd like to revisit the issue as events warrant.
Yes, all right. Okay, thank you. I've been speaking with Enrique Diaz-Alvarez, who works for a small hedge fund on Wall Street that shall remain nameless. And let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about wind farms and such.
Yo, check this out. This is Chuck, the Public Enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI.
And this is WBAI, not only in New York, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit the website, be sure to hit the donate button. We're coming up to a fundraiser. But the more you hit that donate button, the less we have to do some fundraising. So that would be in the interests of all of us, wouldn't it? Okay, let's take a musical break, and then we'll be back to hear from Kurt Davies about wind farms.
Valerie, please believe it never could work out. The time to make plans has passed.
faded away. Ooh, the way you look makes my starry eyes shiver. Then I look away. Too much for one day. One thing we share is an idea of beauty.
And that's some more from Roxy Music. We'll hear one more Roxy Music item at the end of the show, that their Beauty Queen from For Your Pleasure. And it was the Obama administration, specifically the Interior Department under Ken Salazar, approved a plan to build a number of windmills off the coast of Cape Cod, one that had been resisted for many, many years by the Kennedy family and other rich folks who didn't want their view spoiled. But this is probably not the end of it. There's probably going to be more litigation, but this is a significant step forward for all that. So I gave a call to Kurt Davies, who is the research director of Greenpeace, to talk about that and related issues. Welcome, Kurt. The administration has now approved the Cape Wind project off Cape Cod. Tell us about what that entails and what the political meaning of this approval is.
Well, this is a long time coming. This is a project that was started in 2001, and the developer decided that this was a great place to propose a wind farm. It's very shallow water, protected, close to a lot of people, a lot of energy demand, and has great wind. So in doing this proposal, the proponent of the wind farm has had to go through pretty much every environmental law in the country, and we've been a strong supporter of this project from the beginning, knowing that this is a great place to build wind power, and it's a really great day that the Obama administration finally approved the project. So it has federal permission now to move forward, but there's still many opponents to the project, and they are aiming to sue and have, in fact, already preemptively filed to sue to stop it.
And who are these opponents aside from the Kennedy family?
Well, it's actually less driven by the Kennedy family and more driven by other billionaires who live up there. One of the major ones is a guy named Bill Koch, who's related to the New York City Koch billionaire, second richest man in New York, his brother. Bill is another energy guy, and he's thrown well over $1 million, as far as we know, into the campaign opposing the Cape Wind project. And they have mainly used arguments of that seem like environmental arguments, but their real complaint, when it boils down, is aesthetics. They don't want to look at this thing from their multi-million-dollar coastal houses.
The Koch family gives a lot of money to anti-environmental groups, doesn't it?
Indeed, the other Koch brothers are heavy investors in the libertarian movement, the Tea Party movement, a lot of anti-environmental groups, specifically the ones who deny global warming on a daily basis.
What exactly is the potential of wind power in the United States? Is it big?
Wind power has enormous potential for the U.S. People have called North Dakota the Saudi Arabia of wind. If you look at a map, which are easily available online, of potential wind power, it's really the middle of the country that has it all. The east side of the Rockies, where the atmosphere tumbles down out of those mountains, is incredibly windy. It's one of the windiest places on Earth. Now, the problem is there's not a lot of people out there, so you got to get the wind power to people. This is part of T. Boone Pickens' big push that we need long-distance transmission lines to get that to population centers. On the other hand, you have coastal wind power, like the Cape Wind Project, and there are a dozen other projects proposed up and down the East Coast, the Texas Coast, the Great Lakes, where you can put wind turbines out in the water and bring that power to shore where there are lots of people. That's the benefit of a project like Cape Wind or the ones proposed off of Delaware and off of Maryland and off of Texas. You have high population centers near wind power. We know that wind power could provide a much higher percentage of America's electricity. It's presently about the cheapest thing you can do to put new electricity capacity online. And it's growing leaps and bounds right now and probably will continue to do so for many years. if we have good government supports, which is a question mark.
And it also has potential to create lots of jobs. I think the Cape Wind project itself can create about 1,000.
Well, there's a lot of jobs in constructing it, and it's not endless. There are plenty of jobs. For example, Gamesa, one of the biggest Spanish wind farms, just built a new wind turbine factory in Philadelphia on a brownfield, like industrial wasteland site, because they were selling so many turbines to wind parks that are being built in Appalachia and in central Pennsylvania. It was better for them to build the wind turbines here in the United States. Siemens has just decided to open up their headquarters for offshore wind up in Boston. So it will generate a lot of long-term industry, but you know, any power project has a lot of jobs in the construction, and then there's some maintenance jobs and some running the thing jobs. But you know, we have to be clear that this creates a whole lot of economic benefit and environmental benefit that beyond just the jobs: clean air, lower health costs, fewer cases of childhood asthma, better visibility overall from less pollution. Right now, there's an old stinking oil-fired power plant that provides most of the electricity for Cape Cod. There was a terrible oil spill a number of years ago when a barge carrying oil to that power plant burst, hit a rock. So there are many, many other benefits that are beyond just jobs and employment.
You did mention some pseudo-environmental objections to wind farms could interfere with coastal life or coastal wave patterns, or it's going to hurt birds. What about those objections?
The main one that's come up recently is from coastal tribes in Massachusetts who now are claiming that the underwater plateau where this thing would go is former tribal territory during the last ice age, and that it's also a sacred spot for a sunrise ceremony. And these things have been considered by the Department of Interior, and they ruled in favor of the wind farm. But the other concerns, everybody should be concerned about whether or not any industrial project hurts endangered species or harms an ecosystem. Our assessment is that the upside of wind power, the benefit of controlling global warming pollution, far outweighs any other harm that may come from these projects. We're not going to stand by and let a wind farm interfere with a population of whales or sea turtles or migratory birds that our members care deeply about and are obviously crucial. But if we do nothing on clean energy, if we stall solutions like this, the tidal wave of global warming impact will crush those populations, and literally we will not have anything left to save.
What about transmission lines? Are they? They're certainly unsightly, but are they ecologically dangerous in any way?
Birds do run into transmission lines. I think they're in this case, the transmission lines are underwater. They're buried in trenches. They come ashore, and there's already a grid. There's already transmission lines. You don't have to build new ones to bring this power. Not a lot, anyway, to bring this power to people. So that's a benefit of building wind power close to people, versus in Kansas and having to bring it east or somewhere far away from a population center. In those cases, the long-distance transmission lines, there are a lot of different concepts of how that might occur, because you have to prevent losses of electricity. When you run electricity through miles and miles of cable, you actually lose some, and to heat and to just the physics of it. So those have to be, those types of projects should be examined again with our environmental laws, environmental impact statements, and proper assessments, and hopefully we come to the right mix of clean energy that erases our dependence on dirty fossil fuels and cleans up the planet.
And parenthetically, I do recall hearing a lot about the use of water currents to generate electricity. What kind of promise is that?
Well, this is another amazing untapped resource. We have wave power and we have current power. They're doing a project in the East River, in fact, in New York, with great underwater turbines, underwater fans, driven by the massive current that rolls through that river. And wave power is another huge source of energy that's really in development stages to get the durability of these devices down. But there are simple pumps that you can attach to the bottom of the seafloor that are just driven by even small waves and generate a lot of electricity.
It seems like in a lot of these cases, we don't really need a kind of magic bullet technological breakthrough. We can do a lot with what we already have and know, right?
No, exactly. And in fact, countries in Europe are way ahead of us on this. So, you know, wind power in Denmark, in Germany, in Spain is leaps and bounds ahead of the U.S. And it's a shame because the modern wind power industry was born here in the U.S. and then was basically underfunded and abandoned during the Bush years, the Reagan years before that. And, you know, we've never really got our feet back under us, and other countries around the world and companies have taken over. The Japanese took over in solar. Now the Chinese are building all the solar panels, and German and Danish companies are doing all the wind power, and Spanish companies. So, you know, we missed a beat here, but I think, you know, for long-term prosperity of this country, we have to take back the mantle of leadership on clean energy, and we have plenty of potential, and we can drive a lot of our development of wind power into and development of energy into renewables. The other key component, though, to that energy revolution is efficiency, because you want to use energy in the best way possible. You don't want to be gluttonous, you know, and over or waste energy when you're deriving it from wind power. So hand in hand is more efficient appliances, lighting, houses, better insulation, better use of energy, which doesn't mean a diminished standard of living. It actually is an improvement. It means it's your bills are lower. But, you know, these things together can erase the impact of coal, can get rid of dangerous nuclear power, and put us on a path to a safe energy future.
Now, can any of this happen, the sort of thing we're talking about, the alternative energy sources and really aggressive conservation, can any of this happen without active state policy? Is this going to happen spontaneously?
It's happening right now by self-interest in a lot of cases. But, you know, what the problem with, you can't let it happen on its own because the playing field is tilted towards the dirty energy sources, the status quo. We've already got all the infrastructure. We've built superhighways, that therefore we use oil. We've subsidized the transmission lines and the rights of way for all of the current energy supply. And we insure a lot of it. Insurance for the nuclear industry is the only reason these things exist. Now, in the current climate legislation being debated, they get about $50 billion more. So in order to level the playing field, we need to subsidize these things, and we need proper policies that provide incentives for local communities, individuals to buy better appliances. And some of this stuff was in the stimulus program, but having solid long-term policies is why, again, Germany and Spain and Denmark and other countries are ahead of us. We don't have that in this country. We've had these roller coaster subsidies for wind power, for example.
I'm speaking with Kurt Davies, who is the research director of Greenpeace USA. The Obama administration came into office with talking big talk about pushing towards green technology, alternative energy, as both for its environmental virtue and as an economic development strategy for the long term. Have they been delivering on this talk, or is it just talk so far?
Well, you know, they ran into a buzzsaw with this Tea Party nonsense and, you know, the political hatchets who are out there attacking anything he does, no matter what it is. And it turns out that climate and energy and healthcare were the first things that they tried to do. They have done a bit. I mean, the things they've done well, they've done some good stuff on fuel economy standards for cars. They put a lot of billions of dollars into the stimulus package last year to fund better rail transit and rebates for things like appliances and clean energy installation. But on the bigger policy front, the bill that pushed through the House last year, the climate energy bill, ended up basically being business as usual on renewable energy, for example. It didn't do much at all to stimulate a real change in direction on the things that we know need to happen to solve climate change. It didn't hit the targets of what the pollution needs to be reduced, and it didn't throw money at the things that will actually change that. Instead, it subsidizes this mythological clean coal, and it throws more money at nuclear power and the wrong things, the wrong priorities. We're back in that again. Now there's this Kerry Graham Lieberman, or maybe minus Graham, depending on the day, effort going in the Senate. And at its heart, it's a good idea to have a climate bill and have better energy policy passed through Congress, and it may be now or never with President Obama. But we can't have the wrong policies go into place. And my feeling is that the dirty energy lobbyists and industry have the administration on their back foot. They have them in a vulnerable place. They barely passed the health care plan, and they're taking advantage of that by digging for every giveaway they can get. And you know, they got him to say a couple weeks ago, they got the president to stand up and basically say, "Drill, baby, drill." It sounded like Sarah Palin to us. It was unbelievable. Giving away oil drilling on the East Coast, something that has been off limits for many, many years. So, you know, this is a big deal, and we're watching it very carefully and watching the horse trading that's going on here in Washington to sacrifice certainly the perfect for any bill that will come out. We don't know how it's going to go down. The bill is still in limbo because Graham pulled his support because of an immigration fight. But, you know, it would be great to get climate legislation on the books. It would be great for the whole Copenhagen process, the path forward on international negotiation. But we can't have a massive dirty energy subsidy bill with a slight green patina on it.
Yeah, you mentioned clean coal. That is a complete fraud, right? There's no such thing as clean coal.
It's a total scam. It is a PR device, if nothing, if that. What it means, in theory, is a coal-fired power plant that captures the carbon dioxide out of the smoke, out of the emissions, and then bottles that up and stores it underground somewhere forever. So, you know, it's a lot like sweeping the dirt under the rug and hoping it never gets seen again. It's a lot like the problem we have with nuclear power. We've got all these power plants around the country and nothing to do with the waste that's just piling up in communities. So it's a total scam. It was created by a PR firm, basically, and a front group for coal. They ran a $40 million campaign during the election cycle to get the presidential candidates to talk about so-called clean coal. And they've tricked everybody into thinking that this exists already. The ads look like they've already built these things. There's no such thing. And the problem is that even if you are optimistic about the technology, it will not be built in time to solve global warming. It will cost more. It will cost taxpayers in multiple ways. They will charge more for the electricity in the end. And it's simply a false hope at this point.
We've had two very recent disasters that should damage the image of a lot of the things that people are pushing. A coal mine disaster in West Virginia and now an oil spill in the Gulf. What impact have those things had on the political discourse, if any?
They've certainly changed the debate. I mean, you can't talk about clean coal when you have people dying of black lung and then these poor miners being trapped underground. You know, when the truth is when we pull back the curtain and you see the reality of what our addiction to oil causes, when you see this spill in the Gulf that is, you know, an exponentially increasing disaster. Now they're saying it's five times as much oil coming out per day. This is going to be an historic environmental disaster unfolding right before our eyes.
And they're talking about burning it right now to get rid of it?
They tried it last night. They actually burned a bunch last night. And, is that a solution? At least it may keep it out of the national wildlife refuges that dot the coastline down there. But in the end, if they try to burn all this oil, it's going to be like a volcanic eruption. It's going to send black soot up into the atmosphere. It'll be easily visible from satellites. You can already see the oil spill, by the way. In fact, the oil spill, we've just developed a map. If you put that oil spill on the East Coast, where the Obama administration said Virginia can start to look at drilling, if you plant that same oil spill footprint on the East Coast, the oil has already hit New Jersey. The oil could have already hit the Outer Banks of North Carolina, and it would have gone up into the Chesapeake Bay. So this is no small matter, and this is a modern drilling rig in the Gulf. This is not an old jalopy. This is brand new technology, deep water technology, and they blew it. Something went terribly wrong. Despite their protest that everything is cool, this technology is dangerous and will always be dangerous.
I saw the other day that a substantial bit of the oil industry is supporting this Kerry Lieberman, maybe Graham bill. What's in it that has attracted the interest of big oil?
Well, this is fantastic that they supported the House bill, and then some of them pulled out at the last minute because it didn't have enough for oil. So they came back in the fall and they said, well, if you want us to not, and they were all running campaigns against it, basically. The American Petroleum Institute, we revealed last summer, there was a leaked email where they were running fake little Tea Party energy citizens rallies around the country to oppose the bill, basically coming out of the House. They now have turned that around, and in order to get their get them to stand down and not oppose the bill, which I guess the team thinks they need for votes. Kerry actually announced last week that they had American Petroleum Institute's support for the bill and several oil companies specifically supporting it. What they're getting is new access to drilling. We don't know what other giveaways they've gotten, whether it's relaxation of taxes or no new taxes and a sort of status quo guarantee. But apparently they're bought in based on offshore drilling, and that's why Obama did that event a couple weeks ago. This oil spill in the Gulf, I think, will change the dialogue considerably, because if you have coastal state senators supporting offshore drilling in the face of a disaster that is probably going to cause millions, if not billions, of dollars of damages to coastal tourism, you've got multi-billion-dollar industries in the coasts of North Carolina, New Jersey, Maryland, Delaware, South Carolina. Those places cannot handle an Exxon Valdez like event. They cannot handle it, and that's when we start to have hope that we can have a sensible dialogue that's not driven by the power of lobbyists and the power of corporations who dominate Washington. We can start to talk about real term choices and the impacts of bad choices, and maybe we'll get to sane energy policy and smart climate policy someday.
Well, are there any powerful forces on the side of the good guys? I mean, Greenpeace is wonderful, but you're no match for ExxonMobil's lobbying power. How do the forces line up in D.C.?
No, there's no way that Greenpeace has a couple lobbyists. We spend a few dollars up on Capitol Hill. Right now we're lobbying mainly on chemical security and on whaling and other things. But even Greenpeace combined with the Sierra Club, NRDC, all the rest of the big environmental groups are no match for the fleet of lobbyists that have swarmed this city post-Obama to strangle Congress and keep them from doing the right thing. So how do we compete? We do combat with transparency and accountability. We try to reveal what they're trying to do and make news about their secret deals. We tagged Lisa Murkowski earlier in the year for cavorting with Bush-era lawyers, Bush EPA lawyers who are now lobbyists for energy industries. She was trying to handcuff the EPA's Lisa Jackson and keep her from being able to regulate greenhouse gases under current law. So we try, it's sort of hand-to-hand combat. We're trying to just outwit them and outmaneuver them to in any way compete with their power. They have inordinate power over our government and our political process.
Now, the EPA does have power to regulate carbon emissions.
Not only power, if you listen to Lisa Jackson, was on The Daily Show even the other night, it's not a power, it's an obligation at this point. The Supreme Court ruled that the EPA has the authority to regulate greenhouse gases under current Clean Air Act. In fact, the 1970 Clean Air Act, we're on the 40th anniversary of Earth Day and the Clean Air Act, the 1970 Clean Air Act names climate and weather as potential impacts of air pollution. The ruling by the Supreme Court said that the EPA could promulgate regulations under current laws that would limit greenhouse gases, and they named specific gases that the EPA could regulate. So the EPA, even under Bush, had to move a little bit on this, and the Obama EPA is moving even further, and industry, specifically the oil refineries and the utilities, are dead set against this. This is also a reason why they're bought into the Kerry Graham Lieberman bill, which would erase that authority. So they're getting something for siding with that bill, because it would erase current law under EPA's authority, under EPA's purview, that would regulate emissions from oil refineries, from large industry, and from electric power plants.
Well, finally, I do worry that there's not enough public passion in this issue to overcome concerted activities of lobbyists. How do you read public opinion on climate issues?
It's not in a great place right now. I mean, the polling is showing that the deniers are out there confusing people about the science. We had this terrible incident over in November where these stolen emails from climate scientists surfaced, and the denial industry marketed them as a refutation of all the climate science, when in fact they didn't do any of that, and the scientists have been exonerated from any of those charges. And it, you know, you see now in polling people's interest in the issue and the urgency that they see around climate change dropping. But it is really a bad thing, because that means the politicians are not driven to act on it. It's a hard thing to mobilize people around because it seems far away. We do know that there is a core, strong support for action, not only on the specific goal of solving global warming, but also energy security and economic security driven by clean energy and green jobs and so forth. But it has to be driven by the goal of solving climate change, because that really is all that matters in the long term for our children's health and planet.
I've been speaking with Kurt Davies, the research director of Greenpeace USA, based in Washington. Before taking that position, he was the director of Greenpeace's Global Warming and Energy Campaign. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, the final installment of this week's musical tour of my extended post-adolescence, Roxy Music's Street Life, from their 1973 album, Stranded. Till next week, bye.